case of the state of Ford versus Eicher, and the petitioner may proceed.
May it please the court. Good afternoon. My name is Jim Puga. I represent the estate of Catherine Ford. The Colorado Court of Appeals, in reversing the trial court's exclusion of a very discreet, specific causation opinion of the defendant's expert witnesses, erred by concluding that the trial court had applied an inappropriate legal standard. After having then concluded the trial court applied an inappropriate legal standard, the Court of Appeals embarked upon what was essential de novo substitute fact-finding. The Court of Appeals concluded that the trial court balanced two causation theories against each other, found the plaintiffs to be more probable, and therefore excluded the defendants. That is flat wrong. A plain reading of the trial court's order makes it abundantly clear that the trial court did not do that. Rather, the trial court, correctly applying the Schreck standards and actually anticipating the ruling of this court in Ramirez, likely because of the trial court's understanding of law such as People v. Wilkerson, allowed the defendants to put forward all of the potential theories of causation for a brachial plexus injury, including a brachial plexus injury such as Catherine Ford's, an avulsion injury. Everything that the defendants and ACOG contends the literature says, they put forth at trial. They put forth all of that opinion evidence at trial as a potential explanation for an injury such as Catherine Ford's. Every opinion that they cite from other jurisdictions, as well as the Luster opinion in this jurisdiction, simply stands for the proposition that that intrauterine causation theory can come in as a potential explanation. What the Court of Appeals did not understand and did not apply correctly was the Schreck and Ramirez decisions together and what the trial court was actually doing. The trial court was focused on only the specific causation opinion of the defense experts, and only was focused on their ability to state that opinion to a probability. And that is all that the trial court excluded. The trial court excluded Dr. Cooper, and his order makes that abundantly clear. You can read his order to say nothing but Drs. Cooper and Ozunian are only precluded from saying this injury was caused. That is a probability opinion, and that is all that was excluded. It was excluded for Dr. Cooper for the simple reason that Dr. Cooper did not hold it to a probability. It was excluded with regard to Dr. Ozunian because the specific causation opinion that he wanted to state to medical probability, he had no methodology to do other than to believe what Dr. Eicher said. It's exactly what this court rejected in People v. Wilkerson, where the gun expert was going to testify to probability, a 51% probability, that the gun accidentally discharged. It came before this court on a CAR 21 proceeding, and this court considered that very issue of when you're going to go to 51%, when you are going to have that number, you must have a methodology in place. And footnote 10 of the Ramirez opinion, which the Court of Appeals clearly overlooked, deals directly with that issue. And in footnote 10, this court recognized that Nurse Burns, the expert at issue, was not offering a probability opinion. She was offering in the four different categories based on her evaluation what could be a suspicious finding for sexual abuse on the child. And what she said was that it's possible that there was sexual abuse on the child. And this court specifically in footnote 10 noted, Her testimony offered neither statistical, numerical, nor quantifiable conclusions related to her findings. Therefore, we do not require any empirical or methodological justification for the scale, citing the People v. Wilkerson. The trial court in this case understood that if you're going to say it is more likely than not that the posterior shoulder impacted the sacral promontory and the natural forces of labor ripped a nerve root from the spinal cord and ripped two other nerve roots in half, there has to be some scientific methodology for that.
Okay, so can I just stop you there? Wasn't the point that you couldn't test that?
The Court of Appeals was, pardon the pun, hung up on the wrong testing. The trial court was not focused on testing of the general intrauterine contraction theory, such as is the issue in most of the opinions cited by the defendant. If it was directed to the general theories, the trial court would have been duty-bound to keep all of those general theories out. But if you read the transcript from the Schreck hearing, as well as his order, what he's focused on is Dr. Ozunian's opinion. And Dr. Ozunian's opinion is a specific causation opinion that, to probability, the posterior shoulder impacted the sacral promontory and the natural forces of labor caused this injury. At the hearing, he makes clear that that's what he's focused on. At one point, he asks counsel for the defendant at the Schreck hearing this specific question. Is there a technique or is there medical literature, and this is from the December 9th, 2005 transcript of the Schreck hearing at page 58, is there a technique or is there medical literature that can distinguish, if we assume that what happened in this case was excessive force, upward or downward, doesn't matter, is there medical technique or medical literature that can ferret out whether in this case the brachial plexus injury was caused by the contractions of the mother or caused by excessive force? It might be both things. It might be both things are operating to cause the brachial plexus injury, and can your experts distinguish between those two causes? And Ms. Mitchell, as counsel for the defendant, said, no, Your Honor, I don't believe so. We haven't presented them with that question. But I would think that would go to weight rather than admissibility. And the court then went on to say, well, if your experts can't distinguish between the two causes, and the literature can't distinguish between the two causes, then what's really going on is your experts saying, look, we have medical literature that says that this can occur naturally. And if Dr. Eicher did it the way that Dr. Eicher said he did it, here is a potential explanation. And that was the evidence at trial. In fact, all four testifying obstetricians, both of the defendant's experts and both of the plaintiff's experts, agree that if Dr. Eicher performed the delivery in the manner by which he said he did, he could not have caused the injury. And so, they presented alternative explanations. And at the Schreck hearing, the trial court actually posed the question to me, well, are you saying that a possibility can never be probative? This is in the Schreck hearing. And he said, sometimes possibility opinions are highly probative of facts. And if I grant your Schreck motion keeping all of these potential theories out, then the defense is without an alternative explanation should the jury choose to believe Dr. Eicher. He clearly understood what this court was saying in cases such as Wilkerson and what this court ultimately said in Ramirez, which is, if it is a scientific reliable possibility, it can come in. And so all of the intrauterine theories came in. The only thing excluded was that next step. And under Schreck, every step of the expert's analysis is subject to inquiry. And it's that next step of saying, but in this case, this injury to 51% probability was caused by intrauterine forces after the shoulder hung up on the sacral promontory. That's all that was excluded. And in fact, this is from Dr. Ozunian's trial testimony on March 20th, 2006, at page 41. This is what the jury actually heard from Dr. Ozunian. There is a strong suggestion that some brachioplexus injuries may be completely unrelated to manipulations performed at the time of delivery. In these cases, it is most likely that maternal expulsive forces of delivery may be partly or totally responsible for posterior or anterior arm injuries. For example, the posterior shoulder may become temporarily lodged behind the sacral promontory, yet delivery of the head results from maternal expulsive efforts or use of instruments. That was the testimony at trial. That if it's not traction by the physician, the most likely explanation is intrauterine forces. And so the jury, should they have chosen to believe that Dr. Eicher performed the delivery as he said he did, bearing in mind that there is no support in the medical record that the delivery was done as Dr. Eicher said it was done, but should the jury have chosen to believe Dr. Eicher, they were given the most likely alternative explanation by Dr. Ozunian.
Well, counsel, didn't the jury pose several questions about the specific causation here? I mean, you're suggesting that the jury could have done that, but then they posed several questions asking about specific causation.
Your Honor, the jury posed a lot of questions to Dr. Ozunian, a number of which actually went to the informed consent issue in cesarean sections, which, by the way, Dr. Ozunian admitted that Dr. Eicher was negligent with regard to informed consent. There were some questions directed to Dr. Ozunian concerning, can you say it to a probability? But the fact that a jury has a question doesn't determine whether or not the court's evidentiary rulings are incorrect. Juries have questions all of the time that the rules of evidence apply to, and they can't have asked. You can't come back later and say, well, the jury asked if there was insurance, and we couldn't tell them, and therefore we didn't get a fair trial. So, yes, the jury had questions, but the jury had a lot of other questions, a lot of them directed to specific areas that Dr. Ozunian found and admitted that Dr. Eicher was negligent.
Ms. Puga?
Yes.
I sort of want to talk a little bit with you about the fit theory in your briefs.
Okay.
And the lack of, or your argument about fit. And I guess what I find it attractive is two things. Judge Hoffman did italicize this injury at the end of the end of his order, and the fact that he did let both doctors testify generally about this theory. But it seems to me, looking at his particular order, it's not a fit order at all. And it's, he says shoulder dystocia, I can't pronounce it, I'm sorry, is not documented, and so forth. And that would include for both, on both sides in this matter. So it seems to me that it's not he's not really talking about a fit. And secondly, I think, don't you have to look at Dr. Cooper's testimony a little differently than Dr. Ozunian's as to whether or not they're admissible? Because Dr. Cooper just said it was a possible theory, and he never was subjected to a Schreck analysis, right?
Correct, but he would have been subjected to the same Schreck analysis as Dr. Ozunian, and we can conclude that the same conclusions would have been reached, which is the probability opinion to 51% is the only portion you're excluded from asking.
Well, he's answering. Dr. Ozunian's affidavit says it just couldn't happen the way your expert said it did. I mean, basically, that's how I read it.
Well, first,
and so why is that wrong? Why is not necessarily wrong, but why isn't that admissible? Given the fact that the judge let in the general stuff anyway.
Because his affidavit was submitted after the Schreck hearing. They didn't present either of the experts at the Schreck hearing, and what he said in his affidavit is inconsistent with what he said in his deposition, which the trial court had read. Specifically, he made no mention of some of this clinical evidence and clinical bases for his opinion.
Did he discuss in his actual testimony, discuss his clinical experience?
Well, he discussed his clinical experience, and his clinical experience is there's no way to know if a shoulder ever becomes stuck on the sacral promontory. So the issue isn't whether or not a physician can testify based on clinical experience or testify based on literature. The issue is that when you want to take a scientifically reliable theory and apply it and reach a 51% probability in a given case, there has to be some methodology beyond simply saying the doctor said he didn't do it, therefore it has to be this. And that's actually exactly what this court addressed in the Wilkerson opinion, where essentially all the gun expert was saying is, she said it fired accidentally, so it must have fired accidentally. But Justice Bender, back to the specific fit question, no, because at the hearing, what the trial court was specifically making inquiry about is, how do we know? What is our confidence rate? What is our error rate? How do we know how often this happens for intrauterine contractions? And he posed the question directly to counsel for the defendant, Ms. Mitchell. What if it only happens 1 in 1 million times? Doesn't that go to this, you're saying it's a 51% probability? Because remember, this is a case where we had a shoulder dystocia. Nobody knew if it was the anterior or posterior stut. That's all admitted. Everyone agrees that that both shoulders can be stuck and both shoulders can be injured by traction. Everyone agrees that traction was applied after the dystocia. None of those facts were in dispute. And so given that data set, what troubled the trial court and what should trouble this court, because if Ford is not reversed, this conundrum will exist for every trial court in this state, which is, if you're going to take a potential or possibility, which Ramirez clearly now allows, if you're going to take, based on journal literature, peer-reviewed literature, whatever it may be, if you're going to take a scientifically reliable theory and not just offer it as a potential explanation for the injury, but actually say it is the probable 51% or greater explanation, as the law currently stands with the Ford opinion, there doesn't have to be any methodology to reach that type of mathematical conclusion. And that's all the trial court was focused on, and that's all the trial court excluded. Inexplicably, for whatever reason, I mean, the Court of Appeals correctly recognized that, and that's not the inexplicable part, the Court of Appeals correctly recognized that the judge's order, the trial court's order, permitted both witnesses to testify that injuries just like Catherine Ford's can happen in the absence of traction. The inexplicable part is neither one of the defendant's experts were actually asked that question at trial. Neither expert actually had posed to them by defense counsel, can injuries just like Catherine's happen in the absence of traction? And they both would have been permitted to say, yes, they can. They just couldn't take the next step and say, and to probability, that's what happened here. Why? Because just as this court found in Wilkerson and Ramirez in the footnote, when you're going to make that type of probability calculation, you need a methodology. And there was no methodology to fit the facts of this case.
Counsel, can I just follow up on my earlier question then? I guess it's your position that the process of elimination is not a methodology. I mean, that's kind of what the Court of Appeals said was the methodology here, is that the doctor eliminated what the expert eliminated what the doctor in this case did. And I guess it's your position that process of elimination is not, and that's not proper to do that. Sure.
Under the right circumstances, with the right methodology, a diagnosis by exclusion is a proper scientific method. But as set forth in our brief, a diagnosis by exclusion requires that you consider all of the potentials and then that you undertake a scientific, systematic review and elimination of each one of those potentials. And the trial court, doing a correct Schreck analysis and correctly applying the law, said the only way that traction is eliminated in this case is by believing Dr. Eicher when he said, I didn't do it. That's not a diagnosis by exclusion. That's not a scientific method, and that's what the trial court ruled. The trial court recognized that you can eliminate, do a diagnosis by exclusion. So sure, you can do X-rays, blood tests.
But none of that could be done in this case, correct? I mean, is there something that could have been done, some methodology or some test that could have been done?
Yes.
Okay, help me understand that.
Okay. The best way to understand it is to take a look at the seminal piece of literature, which was Exhibit 75, introduced at trial from John Hopkins, and that was gone over in depth at trial, in which 23,000 plus deliveries were looked at, and they were able to break them down into categories by the specific facts of those deliveries. And what they found is that when you have a shoulder dystocia and a severe avulsion injury, that it is almost exclusively, close to 100%, caused by traction related to the preceding shoulder, the antecedent shoulder dystocia. That's a scientific method, and that's what the trial court was asking defendants to do for them. In fact, at the Schreck hearing, he said to defense counsel, if I read your literature, will I find in there somewhere that type of analysis where I can figure out how you come to a 51% probability? And he was assured that it was there, but it wasn't, and it's not, and we can't bring that to you now. What they can bring forward, and what they've continually bring forward, is literature that says there are other potential explanations, and that's what they put forward at trial. So yes, there is a scientific methodology. It's essentially a type of forensic epidemiology or a true mathematical probability calculation where you take a data set of what you're dealing with in this specific case and see how often it relates to traction and how often it relates to non-shoulder dystocia or non-traction. And in fact, there was some examination of Dr. Ozunian about that in his deposition where he conceded that when you have shoulder dystocia, it's like 96% that it's that you're going to have this related to a shoulder dystocia, a brachial plexus injury, and it's only 0.19% when it's, and this is based on his own study, where he said, when I looked at deliveries, only 0.19% of the time could I find that it related to no shoulder dystocia and therefore no traction. 0.19%. And yet when I look at traction and the deliveries related to traction and a shoulder dystocia, it's almost 1 in 5. And that's the kind of analysis that has to be done if you're going to give a probability opinion, as opposed to simply saying these are potential other explanations, which is what every court has said. The Tabor case, on which they heavily rely, clearly says in its conclusion that they can offer this as a potential other explanation, which is exactly what the trial court here allowed them to do. I'd like to reserve my remaining 7 minutes for rebuttal.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, my name is David Yoon, and I represent the respondents, Dr. Eicher, and consultants in obstetrics and gynecology. Sitting at council table are Ms. Ramona Lampley and Mr. Kevin Kuhn, who represent the Amicus Curiae American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. While I will focus on Dr. Ozunian's methodology and why I believe the trial court abused its discretion, Ms. Lampley will discuss more broadly the testability factor to this case and to medical science. I will take approximately 20 to 25 minutes, and Ms. Lampley will take the remaining time. I have to briefly go through the facts slightly to explain Dr. Ozunian's expert opinion. Dr. Eicher was an obstetrician who delivered Catherine Ford. The delivery was complicated by an obstetrical emergency known as shoulder dystocia, where Catherine Ford's left arm, or the arm that's up facing the ceiling, we call that anterior side, was stuck. After the delivery, it was discovered the opposite shoulder, the posterior arm, or the shoulder that was facing the floor, had a brachial plexus injury. And that's the presentation that the baby had. And the shoulder that was stuck on the pubic bone, the left shoulder, wasn't injured at all. And there were two competing explanations as to the cause of Catherine's brachial plexus palsy. One, plaintiff's theory that Dr. Eicher used excessive traction after the shoulder dystocia. And our theory that the injury was caused by intrauterine contraction before the shoulder dystocia. While plaintiff was allowed to present expert testimony supporting its theory, the trial court concluded defendants from presenting any expert opinion that, quote, this injury to Catherine Ford was caused by intrauterine contraction unrelated to shoulder dystocia, close quote.
So, Yoon, can you just, I'm just confused.
Sure.
In the reply brief, Mr. Puga doesn't suggest, that it's unknown, that Dr. Uzunian and Dr. Cooper concede that it's unknown whether she had a posterior shoulder dystocia or a dystocia, or an anterior shoulder dystocia, or both.
Okay.
Were stuck. I mean, it seems like totally contradictory.
That's not true. I will give you the citation.
Okay.
Dr. Eicher testified under oath at trial that Catherine's left shoulder, or the shoulder that was on the anterior side, was stuck. Transcript dated 3/24/06, page 47. Second, Dr. Uzunian gave the following testimony at his deposition. Do you assume, for the purposes of your opinion, that you will give at trial that only the anterior shoulder became impacted or stuck after the head delivered? Answer, yes. Please tell me the complete basis you have to express that opinion. Again, the vast majority, 98% plus of shoulder dystocias are anterior shoulder dystocias. So the common practice, whether it's my case, whoever's case, is when you encounter that to write shoulder dystocia encounter, and I did X, Y, and Z, and whatever. I don't think it's customary practice to say it was specifically say that it was anterior unless it wasn't. So when I see specifically in this case or in other cases references to shoulder dystocia, my presumption, an appropriate presumption, is that it is an anterior shoulder dystocia that was impacted. And this is found in volume 2, page 144 and supplemental volume 2. And further, the same testimony is supported by their own expert, Dr. Edeberg. He testified that 19 out of 20 shoulder dystocias are anterior shoulder dystocias. In other words, 95%. And he testified as follows. Dr. Eicher, this is a question, Dr. Eicher believed that he was faced with an anterior shoulder dystocia. Answer, that's what Dr. Eicher stated at his deposition. Question, would you agree with me that it was reasonable for Dr. Eicher to believe that he was faced with only an anterior shoulder dystocia? Answer, I will agree on that. Question, the injury is consistent, is it not, with anterior shoulder dystocia? Answer, well, 19 out of 20 injuries are anterior, 1 out of 20 are posterior. Transcript date 3/16/06, pages 27 to 29.
So, while you're at it, Mr. Puga suggested that the affidavit, which was filed, that I looked at least, was dated December 19th, which is after the date of Judge Hoffman's order, contained new information or different information that's significant with respect to the deposition that Judge Hoffman, depositions, I should say, that Judge Hoffman reviewed. Do you agree with that?
No, Your Honor. If you look at the entirety of the deposition testimony, of course, Mr. Pugh was asking Dr. Uzunian questions. He made a couple of things clear. One, that Dr. Uzunian believes that it was intrauterine forces that caused pattern force posterior shoulder to impact what is known as sacral promontory before the head is delivered. And he expressed that opinion to a reasonable degree of medical probability. And
what was
testified.
What was his methodology and basis?
He testified that his methodology was differential diagnosis. He testified, and I could go through the methodology, and I could go through it with each of the Schreck factors to show that it's reliable. And one of the Schreck factors the court considered is whether the technique or methodology has been subjected to peer review and publication. Dr. Uzunian, by the way, has been one of the leading researchers in this intrauterine contraction theory. He is probably one of the top five researchers in this area and published numerous peer-reviewed journals. His opinion is based on, as he stated in his affidavit, that with the clinical finding that Catherine had a anterior shoulder dystocia by the posterior injury. And as Dr. Uzunian noted in his affidavit, the only mechanism of injury reported in the medical literature for a brachial plexus injury in the posterior shoulder with an anterior shoulder dystocia.
That's the exact paragraph that I was, was that included in his deposition? Because that was afterwards.
We presented along with his deposition. I believe it is, but
it was dated December 19th. I just looked at it.
Yeah.
The affidavit is dated December 19th.
Yes. I'm saying that I believe he testified to that effect in his deposition. If it wasn't, it was supported by numerous peer-reviewed journals that we submitted that supported that view. And you have to understand that after the ruling, we also moved for a motion for reconsideration. And what we tried to do was we solidified what his basic opinions are so that it's clear to the court. But it was all contained in the deposition along with the medical literature.
How do you explain the this under italicized in Judge Hoffman's order?
I think what Judge Hoffman was doing, you mean the possible? Is that what you're...
Well, I don't know. He said, that makes some sense. He says, I'm alleged to testify to this syndrome, but not about this injury. And he's italicized this injury.
Yes.
Last sentence.
I don't think it's logical what the court did. And that is one of the reasons why I believe it should be reversed.
Because he let the general stuff in and wouldn't let the specific in?
Yes. And the reason is, here's what I believe. If you look at the court's order, just the language of the court's order, the court doesn't distinguish between general theory and specific theory or general theory and Dr. Uzunian's opinion. What the court does ask, and it's quoted, one of the issue before me is, and the court says, are the principles underlying intrauterine contraction theory scientifically reliable? Then he answers no. And in one of the paragraphs, he says, no, because intrauterine contraction theory is not testable. Then he repeats that the problem he has is that this theory is not testable. And at the very end, he says, I'm not going to allow the doctors to testify that this injury occurred through intrauterine forces, but allow general. And I do not know why he did that, but I don't think the plaintiff's interpretation makes any sense. Because if the plaintiff argues that the general theory, the court found the general theory reliable, but Dr. Uzunian did not connect the theory to the facts in this case, I would submit to you that would be completely irrelevant. You can't present a theory to the jury when it's not connected to the facts in the case.
At best, what most should have been able to be said by the expert?
I think the expert should have been able to say that in this case, Catherine Ford's injury was caused by intrauterine forces when her posterior shoulder impacted a bony structure known as sacropromontory and stretched her brachial plexus and caused an injury before the head delivered.
Is that based on the 95% of these instances, that's what happens?
No, it's based on a number of factors.
Okay, oh, sure.
Okay. One is differential diagnosis. Another.
What does that mean? You've said that
exclusion,
a few times.
A process of elimination.
And how does that tie into a decision that this was the cause in this case?
There were two known causes in the literature. So one is, could it be intrauterine forces, right? And how do you know that? You look at, first of all, you look at computer and mathematical modeling, which shows that intrauterine contraction, the mother pushing and the contraction, could be 4 to 9 times greater the clinician applied traction. This combined with human anatomy, the baby's descent down the birth canal, indicates that the baby's shoulder can impact the bony structure known as sacropromontory before the head is even delivered. And clinical finding supports this view because you have a anterior shoulder dystocia by the posterior injury. Then Dr. Ruzumi in his affidavit excludes excessive traction. He explains that excessive lateral traction is excluded because while excessive traction can cause a brachial plexus injury to the shoulder that's up with an anterior shoulder dystocia because you got the shoulder stuck, it cannot cause injury to the posterior brachial plexus, the opposite shoulder. Then he excludes upper traction in his affidavit because Dr. Eicher testified that he did not apply upper traction, number one. And in his deposition, if you look at, I think, page 146 of Supplemental Volume 2, he says physicians are not trained to apply upper traction during delivery. They're not taught in residency or in medical school. You apply general downward traction. More importantly, he says in his affidavit, there is nothing in medical literature that substantiates that upper traction can cause brachial plexus injury to the anterior shoulder. And then in his deposition, if you look at it, he said, by the time the head delivers the posterior shoulder, I'm sorry, by the time the head delivers, the posterior shoulder has passed over the sacrum and it abuts against soft tissue, but it's not against any bony type structure posteriorly. And that's found on Supplemental Volume 2 at page 140. Therefore, I think the differential diagnosis is not just based on what Dr. Eicher said. Of course, you can rely on his sworn testimony, but it's also based upon the clinical presentation, his elimination of other causes, and based on peer review and knowledge of human anatomy and how the baby descends and what it could possibly, how the shoulder could impact the bony structure. So I believe it's scientifically reliable.
What about Mr. Pugas? I thought he argued that the parties could not agree or did not agree on which shoulder had been impacted. Yeah, I mean, didn't he say that?
He said that there's no evidence, I believe, in his brief, which shoulder was impacted. And I think I just...
And I take it you disagree with that.
Yes, and I read to you the testimony and is supported by the testimony, so...
And what was her testimony... by the plaintiff's experts saying the opposite, or what was the plaintiff's expert?
I read that deposition, trial testimony, and I believe he said both shoulders were stuck.
At different points in time, I guess. Both shoulders were stuck, but I assume at different points in time.
I believe they believe, when after they had delivered, they, the plaintiff's expert believes that both the anterior shoulder was stuck on the pubic bone and the posterior shoulder was stuck on sacral hollow. I believe that's his opinion. But we disagree, and he even acknowledged, and our expert says, that soft tissue dystocia, if it's anything.
What about the idea that the jury had plenty of other alternatives to consider and did this fairly, and talk a little bit about the harm, sure. The harm of this exclusion.
Sure. Well, the harm was great because if you look at the record, first of all, you could look at the court's specific finding and realize how important it is. The trial court said, before it got into the reliability, I found that this causation opinion would extremely be helpful to the jury and may, at the end of the case, be called upon to decide whether Dr. Eicher's version of the delivery is credible and whose answer to that question may turn on whether there is any credible explanation for Catherine Ford's injuries. It is clear to me, and I find that the highly probative value of an alternative explanation for this injury far outweighs any undue prejudice. Then you get to the trial, and after each of these experts testified, and I'm going to just read you some of the questions, the following questions were asked by the jury. One question, you stated that you do not think the delivery team contributed to Catherine Ford's injuries. What then do you think is the most likely cause for her severe brachial plexus injury? They said BPP. Another question, do you think it is probable that an intrauterine brachial plexus injury could have occurred and gentle traction could have worsened the injury? Would this still be in the standard of care? Another question, you have stated that there are other possible causes of BPP other than traction by the delivery dock. Is it likely that these other causes would result in BPP as severe as Catherine Ford's, in your opinion? And after those questions were asked, the trial court refused to allow the experts to answer those questions based on the prior pretrial ruling. Even the prejudice, it was also summarized in plaintiff's counsel's own words. He said that these other alternative explanations, he said, were a bunch of hypotheses, maybes, and possibilities. And he rhetorically asked the jury, Catherine Ford may have the same question that some of you have. If this wasn't excessive traction with the shoulder dystocia, what was it? What was it? And she, like you, sat here waiting for somebody from the defense to sit in that stand and say, I can tell you to a reasonable degree of medical probability that this is the cause of her injury, not traction. And no one did. No one of their witnesses answered that question that she has and you have. And I would submit no one answered that question because the trial court prohibited our defense expert from answering it. And that is prejudicial. I believe I have 9 minutes, and I will give my time to ACOG to present their argument.
May it please the court. My name is Ramona Lampley, and I represent, along with Kevin Kuhn, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, and its more than 54,000 practicing members. First, I would like to express my own and my client's gratitude to the court for allowing us to appear before the court today and express our constituents' views with respect to this issue. The college represents 90% of the practicing obstetricians in this country. These obstetricians are the physicians that are on the front lines of delivering rooms and operating rooms, delivering babies each day, encountering medical emergencies, and making on-the-spot decisions regarding those medical emergencies that often arise without warning and due to no fault of the physician. So why is the college interested in this argument today? The reason, put simply, is that should this court affirm the trial court's decision, then an otherwise reliable medical model as applied to the particular facts of the case can be excluded under SHREC simply because it cannot be tested will render inadmissible a wide array of medical opinion testimony that equally cannot be tested and will impose a de facto strict liability standard on obstetricians in other shoulder dystocia cases. The incongruency in the trial court's opinion is highlighted by the fact that the plaintiff's expert's opinion that excess traction caused Catherine Ford's injury equally cannot be tested. And so here, the Court of Appeals actually correctly held that the trial court applied the incorrect legal framework by focusing...
Excuse me, Ms. Lampley, related to the testability issue, it seemed to me that Mr. Puga cited an empirical study at Johns Hopkins, which indicated that maybe not tested, but at least that was a clinical, legitimate, empirical observation that essentially intrauterine theory was pretty rare. Is that right or not?
I believe that that statement is a mischaracterization of this Johns Hopkins study, Your Honor.
And is that old medicine, or is it?
I'm sorry.
Is that old medicine and old research, or is it something that you're
within the medical literature? There is a conflict, and that is the expert's job to explain the importance and weight. But this same study, and other studies that predate it, when they focus on the posterior injury, particularly when we have an anterior dystocia, the majority of them agree that the posterior injury is most likely explained by intrauterine forces. The plaintiff has, or appellant has, cited the study for the theory that 90% of injuries are related to shoulder dystocia cases. That does not exclude the potential for both intrauterine forces and shoulder dystocia to be at work. So to say that only 10% only involve intrauterine forces would be a mischaracterization. The consensus in the medical community is that a posterior injury is more likely explained by intrauterine forces. And that is because when an expert employs the medical science and knowledge of the female anatomy here, the posterior shoulder, once it passes the sacral promontory, doesn't have another similar structure to get hung up on. That's soft tissue. And that is extremely rare. That happens in only some studies say 2% of cases. I believe that the appellant's expert in this case said 5% of the cases. So the Court of Appeals correctly held that the trial court abused its discretion by focusing solely on the testability factor here for three reasons. First, this court's jurisprudence under SHREC has never required a finding of testability for an expert opinion to be reliable. And to do so would exclude many medical studies on fetal hypoxia, medical studies on cancer treatment, simply because we cannot ethically expose human beings to that kind of study. That does not mean that those theories are unreliable. Here, the peer-reviewed literature accepts that intrauterine forces is another possible explanation for brachial plexus palsy. Other courts who have considered this issue have permitted testimony that it was the cause of the particular plaintiff's injuries, even when we don't have clinical evidence, as we do here, that there was a posterior injury and a more likely anterior dystocia. Additionally, the analyses on which these studies are based bring additional weight to their reliability. These are not medical theories that are drawn out of the air. These are based on retrospective analysis, 20 years of retrospective analysis, where experts gather the data, examine the type of dystocia, the physician comments, and attempt to come up with what else is happening in the female anatomy that is causing these types of brachial plexus palsies when there is no traction. And over again in the literature that the college has cited on page 14 and 15 of their brief is the fact that posterior shoulders can display a brachial plexus palsy is evidence of the fact that the intrauterine forces theory is reliable. Finally, Dr. Azudian, his methodology is the methodology that is accepted by other physicians in their practice. He did rely on Dr. Eicher's testimony that no excess traction was applied. But additionally, he considered the clinical factors. The likelihood that, according to Dr. Eicher's testimony, this was an anterior dystocia. In the overwhelming majority of cases, there is an anterior dystocia, that it is a rule of physician practice, that unless it is an anterior dystocia, the physician just writes dystocia. So he considered each of those clinical factors in concluding that it was likely an anterior dystocia and a posterior injury. Then Dr. Azunian relied on the medical literature that has analyzed posterior injuries with anterior dystocias and has concluded that those are most likely not due to physician traction, but are due to the internal maternal expulsive forces.
What is the evidence that the doctor could have used excessive traction?
What is the evidence?
Yeah, that the jury relied on.
I was not at trial, Your Honor, but my belief is that it would be their expert opinion that this is what happens in shoulder dystocia cases. This is a potential cause.
A potential cause, but there was no evidence that this was the actual cause? Or
excess traction?
Right.
No defense witness testified that there was excess traction. But I'll defer to...
how about the plaintiffs?
How about the plaintiff's evidence of excess traction?
Yeah, right.
My understanding of the record before the court is that that was relying on expert testimony, that for many years the medical community has recognized excess traction as a potential cause of shoulder dystocia, and before 20 years of research as one of the main causes of shoulder dystocia.
I'm talking about the evidence that went to this specific case. What's your understanding? I'll ask them, but
my understanding
I didn't hear the explanation of what that evidence is.
My understanding is that there was no fact witness testimony that any excess traction was applied, that it was gentle traction only. Yes, Your Honor. And in conclusion, the relief that my client and its more than 50,000 practicing obstetricians are seeking is straightforward. It is simply to be able to present evidence based on a reliable medical theory that has undergone years of research on a level playing field as the plaintiff's experts, and to not have that evidence precluded for the simple fact that it cannot be subject to error rate testing. Thank you for your time.
It would take me substantially longer than the 7 minutes I have left to debunk the discussion of the literature that has occurred. That's not the job of this court. We're not scientists. I can debunk immediately one of the statements that was made, that there is a study that shows that the in-uterine forces are 4 to 9 times greater than those applied by a clinician. The literature put into this case by ACOG itself, as cited in my brief, says that is a flawed study. It's based on flawed mathematical models. And it references forces that, if that was actually true, exceed the fatal limits on the fetus. The 4 to 9 times that they're talking about would kill the baby. I could go through and debunk everything that has been said. I will debunk what Mr. Yoon said about whether this was known to be anterior or posterior. You have to listen very carefully. The question that he was asked and that was referred to was, for purposes of your opinions, do you assume that this was an anterior shoulder dystocia? That's what he read you. I cited in my brief every spot where they agreed, both defense expert witnesses, that there was no evidence as to whether this was anterior, posterior, or both. The medical record, which we attached to our brief, is completely devoid of any references to whether this was anterior, posterior, or both? Dr. Eicher, in his testimony, said, I don't know if it was anterior, posterior, or both. Every expert witness, including the defense expert witnesses, said, you can have an anterior dystocia, a posterior dystocia, or both. If you have a posterior shoulder stuck, every expert witness in the case, including the defense expert, said, traction will cause the injury. The literature that they're referring to about the sacral promontory theory is in cases in which there is no shoulder dystocia. And therefore, they looked for another explanation. And they found six cases that they talked about. Six! With an avulsion and no shoulder dystocia. That's what was presented to the trial court. Okay? The 2005 Hopkins article is not old medicine. It's from 2005. And it says, we have established that in the rare deliveries, not recorded as shoulder dystocia, but regular plexus palsy is permanent, the residual deficit is nearly always mild. That's not Catherine Ford. She had a nerve root ripped from her spinal cord and two of them ripped in half. Whereas nerve root avulsions, that's what she had. And or complete brachial plexus impairment, that's what she has, occur almost exclusively with antecedent shoulder dystocia. The facts in this case are there was a shoulder dystocia. It is unknown, admittedly by everyone, that it's anterior or posterior. The defense experts assume it was anterior. Now, I want to address the issue about the clinical evidence. No, his affidavit was not consistent. He was asked in his deposition, Supplemental Volume 2, at page 219 through 220, to give everything on which he is basing his opinion. He never once mentioned the clinical evidence of the facial bruising, the nerve palsy in the face. What our expert said, though, is those are the hallmark signs of traction. So was there evidence of traction, contrary to what you were just told? Absolutely. The experts agreed that those marks on the baby's face and the nerve palsy on the baby's face are the hallmark signs of traction. Mr. Ford, who has witnessed the delivery of three of his children, including the second one that had a shoulder dystocia that was handled correctly and there was no injury, testified that what he saw was nothing close to what he saw in the other deliveries, that there was traction on that baby's head in every different direction. Yes, there was evidence of traction. Now, Mr. Yoon told you that the clinical basis to say that it was intrauterine forces was that it was, remember, an ROA, and therefore the shoulder that was injured was down. Okay, it was posterior. If we flip Catherine over and put her in an LOA position, then that right shoulder would be anterior. It would be the up shoulder, right? He was asking his deposition, assume everything in this case is exactly the same. Everything equal. This is Supplemental Volume 2 at page 231. But instead of ROA, it's LOA. So now we have an anterior shoulder injured. Would your opinion change? And he said, no. It would not change with respect to excessive traction or some other upward traction or down. You know, we talked about upward traction, downward traction, and so on. Those things would not change. Question, because Dr. Eicher said he didn't do that. Correct. And so it would be your opinion, regardless of whether it's anterior or posterior, it would be your opinion, it would still just be the labor forces, the natural forces, and he said that's right. It doesn't matter to Dr. Ozumian if it's anterior or posterior. He is simply taking Dr. Eicher's word that he did not apply excessive traction. That can be no more clear than that statement in his deposition. I don't care if it's an anterior or a posterior. He said he didn't do it. Therefore, it must be something else. And that's exactly what this court strongly rejected in People v. Wilkerson at 114 P3rd 877. Given the specific terms in which the opinion was offered in this case, and especially the danger that the expert would be understood simply as vouching for the defendant's account of events, it would be difficult to find an abuse of discretion in rejecting that opinion. Dr. Ozunians, intrauterine general theories were not excluded because they couldn't be tested, which is what is being suggested here. ACOG is here because ACOG wants this court to become the scientific panel and issue an opinion that says when there's a posterior shoulder dystocia and an avulsion to medical probability, it's intrauterine forces, and that's not your job. Your job is to look at what the trial court did. The trial court correctly applied the Schreck factors, did not find one theory more than the other. They could have challenged our theory, never did. There was nothing manifestly.
I didn't quite get that. I thought they were saying that they needed a fair shot to put in a contrary professional opinion.
I'm out of time, but I'm...
Please, would you?
Absolutely, absolutely. That may be, Justice Hobbs, the single most disturbing factor raised by the defendants. This is unfair because the plaintiffs got to have their experts say to medical probability, and we didn't. They didn't challenge our experts. We filed a Schreck brief and challenged their witnesses. They did not file a Schreck brief and challenge ours. It's not as if the judge had before him a Schreck challenge to both opinions and let us say the probability and them not. The judge had only before him a challenge to whether they could say to probability that opinion. Thank you.
On behalf of the court, I want to thank all counsel for your arguments. The case will